Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Historically, thousands of murders are classified as unsolved across the UK. Modern forensic techniques help families find justice even after decades have passed.
I'm Wensley Clarkson, and you're listening to the Real Silent Witnesses podcast from Graphic Audio, a podcast series that delves into the scientific leaps in forensics. In each episode, we will meet forensic experts and journalists who work tirelessly to help families that deserve answers, and we will examine the techniques that help solve the most difficult cold cases.
Throughout the show, you'll hear extracts from my book, The Real Silent Witnesses. This is The Real Silent Witnesses, The Serial Killers. Welcome, Professor Glenn Wilson, to The Real Silent Witnesses podcast. Glenn, you were visiting Professor of Psychology at Gresham College London from 2009 to 2014. You've been a reader in personality at the Institute of Psychiatry at King's College London, as well as being a fellow of the British Psychological Society. So, Glenn, I'm hoping to initially focus on the forensic aspects of how to work out who a serial killer is by using the clues that they leave behind. It seems to me that psychology has evolved into being a vital part of the forensic process. Would you agree?
Well, it can help a little bit. It can also lead people down blind alleys.
Let's start with the positive side of it. What are the potential clues that might tell you something about somebody in relation to an offender?
Yeah, well, profiling in the past tended to be a bit psychoanalytic. They'd worry about whether the killer was acting out hatred for the mother, that sort of stuff, and that seldom helps you find a serial killer. What profiling does quite successfully is to link up different crimes to tell you that it's the same individual from his MO and the signatures that he leaves behind. And it will also usefully tell you what state of mind they were in at the time of the killing, whether it was a frenetic blitz of some sort or whether it was a calculated, fully planned ritual.
Give me a practical example of that. If you walked into a room, what would you see that would tell you that?
Well, if you take the O.J. Simpson crime scene, for example, what you saw were a couple of dead bodies lying in a pool of blood on the doorstep and a whole lot of bloodied footprints running down the path and away. And it was clearly an unplanned, hostile, jealous outburst that led to that killing. Whereas in another crime scene, you might find the victim has been carefully bound, that there are signs of ritual and sadism in the act, as though the killer was enjoying the process, prolonging it as much as possible. And although they might display the corpse in certain ways to show their pride in their business, they are very careful not to leave anything behind that the police can use to locate them.
Isn't there a grey area there, Glenn, between, you know, when we read or hear about murders where the victim has been stabbed or shot many times, and there's some emotion involved in this, obviously, and yet there's also a frenzied side to it, which doesn't necessarily mean that actually the perpetrator knew the victim. If I read about a murder and, you know, and it seems to be in cold blood, but actually the victim suffered multiple stab wounds, for example, you see, you tend to think they must have known them.
An ordinary murder is usually just sufficient to kill the person and doesn't go beyond that, whereas serial killers often use something called overkill, which is doing more than is necessary to actually kill the person, tends to go with other things like removing trophies that they can use to revive the experience and fantasy afterwards. But there is every indication that they have planned the event in advance. They've maybe made preparations at the crime scene, bondage equipment and so on, that they might have torture instruments. And that while they don't know the individual personally, the individual corresponds to a type.
So it's like an attraction thing, in a sense.
It is. Serial killers tend to kill people to whom they are attracted. Ted Bundy would say that the women he killed were attractive to him. And they all, in fact, were young women to him. They are part of the sexual excitement scenario.
And go back to trophies for a second. These trophies are items that a serial killer takes from the scene of a crime, which he then uses for whatever reason to remind himself of what he's done. And what I would love to know is, what are the most bizarre trophies you've ever heard about?
I'm not sure about bizarre. I think they're mostly items of jewellery or underwear, and they have a very personal and semi-sexual connection to the person, like a high-heeled shoe or something. And they maybe they take the same trophy on each occasion, which they will use to register the a sort of a total history of their exploits, or sometimes just a reminder of the most recent one, which might get them through, along with fantasy and masturbation, until the urge to kill recharges itself.
But would some of the trophies have a link to a perpetrator's childhood?
Only in the sense that in their childhood you will get the pattern of sexual excitement that is beginning to develop. For example, the case of Dennis Nielsen, he saw the corpse of his favourite grandfather in an open coffin, and he was traumatised by the loss of that man. But also, in some sense, found the corpse to be sexually exciting. He somehow attached that to his sexual urges, so that when later on he took up serial killing, he was trying to render the young men that were his victims in a state of immobility, unconsciousness, and eventually death, because this was what turned him on. He had become a necrophile.
As in the title of the classic book about the case, Killing for Company, there was an element of loneliness with Nielsen. He wanted to keep those bodies close to him.
So it seemed that if they were particularly attractive, they were allowed to stay around for a bit longer. If he didn't fancy them all that much, they'd go under the floorboards a bit more rapidly, I believe. But he certainly found these young men attractive, and he found them particularly attractive when they were immobilized. And of course, the best way to do that was to strangle them, drown them, and then he could be sure that the corpse wasn't going anywhere for a while.
Now, let's take you back to something that you touched on a few minutes ago, which I know you feel strongly about. Profiling can often be very misleading when it comes to examining forensic evidence. And a classic example of this was in the Rachel Nickell case. Here's an extract from the audiobook to help set the scene.
The murder of young mother Rachel Nickell stunned and horrified the British public. On a summer's morning in July 1992... the 23-year-old was stabbed 49 times and sexually assaulted as she walked through Wimbledon Common with her 2-year-old son and the family dog. It appeared to have been a frenzied attack by a complete stranger. There were no witnesses except Rachel's distraught 2-year-old son, Alex, who was later found by a dog walker clinging to his mother's blood-soaked body. So began one of the most problematic investigations ever carried out by London's Metropolitan Police. Initially, detectives identified a 29-year-old unemployed local man called Colin Stagg, a frequent visitor to the common while walking his dog, as their number one suspect. Detectives had little more than a hunch to go on at that stage, so they launched Operation Edsel in order to prove Stagg was Rachel's killer. An undercover policewoman attempted to get information from Stagg by pretending to be romantically interested in him. The pair regularly met up, had numerous phone conversations, and even exchanged letters containing sexual fantasies. As Stagg gradually developed a trust in the undercover officer, he confessed to his own violent fantasies. He never actually admitted to murdering Rachel Nickell, though. After police had secretly recorded a meeting between the female officer and Stagg, detectives were sanctioned by the Crown Prosecution Service to arrest Stagg and charge him with Rachel's murder. At the eventual trial, it was revealed that the police evidence was far from concrete. Stagg continued to deny any involvement in the Wimbledon Common murder, and it became apparent during the trial that the police attempt to entrap Stagg had left huge holes in the case against him. Eventually, the judge presiding over the case ruled that the police had shown excessive zeal and accused them of trying to incriminate Stagg by deceptive conduct of the grossest kind. Every aspect of the police's entrapment evidence was dismissed, and the prosecution was forced to withdraw their case. Colin Stagg was formally acquitted in September 1994. The Metropolitan Police were deeply embarrassed by the failed prosecution of Colin Stagg for Rachel's murder. For a couple of years, they behaved as if they simply wanted it to go away, and some officers still insisted that Stagg was guilty, despite the judge's comments at his earlier trial.
I know you feel quite strongly about this case being a classic example of when forensic profiling led the police up the wrong garden path with disastrous consequences.
That's exactly what happened, yes. They drew up a profile of the likely murderer, and because they had no forensic evidence, they put on his tail an attractive young policewoman who looked a little bit like his victim, with the brief to evoke from Stagg some fantasies that approximated to the killing itself. And she did that quite effectively. She never got a confession out of him, although he confessed to a murder that hadn't happened down in the New Forest, because it was clear that she was teasing him, that she was implying that if he was the Wimbledon Common murderer, she would be so turned on by this that she would leap into bed with him immediately. So she was shaping his fantasies to correspond with the events of the killing. And I was brought in for the defense of Stagg with that argument that the fantasies that she had extracted were in fact carefully reinforced or shaped in a Skinnerian kind of a way, and therefore they were not compelling evidence at all.
It seems incredible, Glenn, doesn't it, that this happened? It was 28 years ago, the case was a couple of years later, but I can't believe that this sort of situation would happen today. What do you think?
I hope it doesn't. I think it's less likely to happen as a result of lessons learned from the past, but the worrying thing about it particularly was that in the case of Colin Stagg, because the one thing that didn't fit the profile was a background of criminality, they charged him with obscenity because he admitted having been nude sunbathing on the common in the past. So he got this charge laid against him and was convicted of it, and the tabloids were then able to say that he was an established sex criminal.
It just seems incredible now. Do you think that this, what happened with Colin Stagg in the Rachel Nickell case, is somehow reflective of how the relationship between the police and forensic psychologists and other forensics in general, the relationship between the police and them was often quite strained? I don't think it is so much now. Do you think that's part of it?
Well, psychiatrists tend to disagree, for example, about whether an individual like Nielsen is responsible for his actions or not. They tend to disagree whether he was in control of himself or whether he shouldn't be held responsible. You can always find a psychiatrist to take up a particular point of view. And the same with profiling. I mean, we had one psychologist provide a profile that Colin Stagg seemed to fit, and indeed he did. But the police then insisted that that because he fitted the profile, it was like having a fingerprint or a DNA reading or something, that this was evidence against him, when in fact it should never have been used for anything more than guidance.
It was indeed a combination of DNA reading and other evidence that brought the real killer to justice.
In 2001, 7 years after Stagg's acquittal, Scotland Yard announced they were going to re-examine evidence gathered at the time of Rachel's murder from the crime scene and use some of the latest advances in forensic technology to study every relevant item. More significant improvements in the DNA testing system had just come into force, so this was used on traces of DNA found on Rachel's body. The murder itself was completely re-evaluated in a bid to identify certain patterns of behavior exhibited during the attack, which might provide further clues as to the identity of the real killer of Rachel Nickell. Investigators pledged to look further afield to see if her murder could be connected to any other similar killings. Samples taken from Rachel Nickell's body were eventually analyzed using a specialized technique known as low copy number DNA. This was supposed to amplify minute quantities of DNA evidence to allow match to be found, but as in the earlier test, this technique failed. The new forensic team examining the Rachel Nickell case decided to dilute a renegade DNA sample they had recovered back down to its original level. That resulted in a mixed DNA profile, which contained a minor male component, which had to belong to her killer. And that sample of DNA did not match Colin Stagg's. The same lab verified that this latest DNA profile was 1.4 million times more likely to have come from a known serial killer called Robert Napper. He'd been an original suspect who had actually failed twice to provide DNA samples to police. The new team of investigators noticed similarities between the Nickell case and a double murder carried out in May 1994 by Napper. Just 16 months after Nickell's murder, Napper had been convicted for the murder and sexual assault of a mother and her 4-year-old daughter. Napper had been sent to the Maximum Security Psychiatric Hospital, Broadmoor, for that other double murder, a rape and 2 attempted rapes. He was suspected of being the Green Chain rapist who'd carried out numerous sex attacks in southeast London in the early 1990s. But the DNA sample was not considered safe enough evidence to convict Napper. The forensic team working on the Rachel Nickell case examined hair combings taken from her toddler son Alex and found flakes of red paint that would eventually be matched to a toolbox found at Napper's home. Finally, the forensic team reconstructed some of the events of the day of the murder on Wimbledon Common itself. At one stage, forensic scientists got down on their hands and knees on the common and were able to establish that the kind of shoes Napper had been wearing in those ground conditions could leave prints smaller than the heels themselves, just like the prints left on the path near where Rachel was murdered. On the 18th of December 2008, Robert Napper pleaded guilty to the manslaughter of Rachel Nickell on the grounds of diminished responsibility due to his diagnosed paranoid schizophrenia. He was sent back to Broadmoor Hospital indefinitely.
I'd really like to pick this apart. What concerns me most of all is that it really suggests to me that criminal profiling, in a sense, is dead in the water because it's been taken too literally in the past.
It really depends upon what the police make of it. Something similar happened in the Jill Dando murder. They picked up a local loser who was a bit weird, and they somehow got into a head that he was definitely the bloke, and it was just a question of getting evidence against him. But the evidence was extremely weak. It was widely reported, for example, that he had a whole lot of news clippings about Jill Dando in the house. In fact, they hadn't been clipped out of the paper. They hadn't even been circled with a pen. There were just a whole lot of newspapers lying around in the house, some of which mentioned Jill Dando because she was a famous celebrity of the day and hence appeared in a lot of those newspapers. But they somehow managed to make more out of that than they should have.
Do you think that inadvertently psychological examinations of these sort of cases have been used by the police sometimes, especially back then, to give them an excuse to go like, wow, we've got a chance here of signing off on this crime. Let's just go for it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for the most part, the police are reasonably sensible. And when the crimes are solved, it is done by traditional police methods, regardless of what the profiler said. So to be fair to the police, they do know how to get the sort of evidence that they really need. Just that there was a time when they got too enthusiastic and they get it into their head that a particular individual is the criminal that they're after, and they will fit the evidence around that. I think it happens less today, partly because it's the sort of thing that defence lawyers are always looking for, and the police can be left very red-faced if they're exposed.
I'd like to interrupt you here and take a closer look at what in my book I call psychological footprints. That is to say, the techniques that make it possible to profile serial killers.
The majority of forensic scientific techniques rely mainly on physical evidence. But there is another approach to murder cases that can provide investigators with genuine, significant breakthroughs. This involves psychological assessment of what's going on in a suspect's head in order to try and come up with vital, tangible evidence that will help detectives to apprehend a criminal and even secure a conviction. Unsurprisingly, trying to work out the identity of a killer and what has driven that person to commit murder and carry out sex crimes is a complex process. Forensic psychologists have to dig deep to find out what is going on in the human brain, and this is when they work best alongside police officers in order to profile criminals. One UK forensic psychologist explained, "The key to all this is knowing why some people commit crimes and others don't. It means trying to get beneath the surface of people's personalities, which is especially hard when it comes to criminals. By nature, they like to hide most stuff." Many forensic psychologists admit that common sense often plays a huge role in helping them to understand a case, especially if they are brought in after a crime, often murder, has been committed but before a suspect has been apprehended. This can prove particularly useful when there is no obvious suspect, explained one recently retired London Murder Squad detective. "We have nothing to lose, and I've been astonished over the years how accurate forensic psychologists often turn out to be. They seem to be able to use crime scene evidence and geographical positions of crimes to build a picture of a suspect. A lot of my colleagues used to ignore this sort of stuff. I learned over the years that every suspect, even the ones we don't know about, leaves a psychological footprint behind them, even if there is no physical evidence of who they are. One of the key indicators of an offender's identity obviously revolves around the type of crime they're alleged to have committed, as well as the way it happened, and a timeline of everything that led up to the crime and its subsequent aftermath. This can result in a profile that can turn out to be a remarkably accurate description of a suspect. Many forensic psychiatrists believe that personality disorders are the root cause of most serious offences, especially murder and rape. Often these perpetrators have earlier committed other less deadly crimes. Forensic psychiatrists have discovered through their work that many of the worst types of killers and rapists often were stalkers and voyeurs when they were younger. One forensic expert explained, "We can read a lot into who these characters are through the past as well as the present. So often there is a behavioral trail that leads from someone's childhood all the way to the crime they have committed. The nervous systems of some killers is different from the rest of the population because they can't get a thrill from the sort of things normal people would. That's what often leads to subversive behaviour such as voyeurism and stalking during their teenage years. It is our job to map out how they came to develop from those crimes into murderers.
So, Glenn, I wonder how much you feel you can relate to what this forensic expert says. I'm wondering how deep do you go as a forensic psychologist to dig when you're trying to establish clues? Do you examine closely not just the evidence that's there, but if there are a number of suspects that the police have for a serial killing, for example, would you try and dig as deep as you could into each subject, into each individual, to try and see if they fit in any way the profile?
Yes, I think rather than a personality profile of the kind that we've been talking about so far, the more important clues come from things like travel and escape routes, geographical things, where the perpetrator is likely to live. This is called geographical profiling and is probably more useful to the police than the old psychoanalytic, what type of person do we have here, and some sort of semi-mystic or magical interpretations of what was going on in the head of the individual. It's where does he work? Does he work in the week, at night? There was a, in the case of the Yorkshire, the actual Ripper, the original Whitechapel Ripper, there was a chap who's quite recently come to light called Charles Letchmere, who was actually there on the scene for the second killing when the police arrived. And he said, oh, it's too bad, isn't it? I just stumbled across this. But if you look at his movements between home and work, they correspond to the sort of times when the other killings were occurring. This was a chap who worked in Bethnal Green, and at a meatpacking works or something, he had to arrive there at 4 a.m. And he was passing these crime scenes, you could plot it all on a map, at almost exactly the time that the killing occurred.
In terms of cases you've personally been involved with, could you tell us one that you feel is, you know, obviously been dealt with now, or you don't even necessarily have to name them, but is there one that a notable case where you've come up against a lot of difficulties because of the circumstances?
Most of my work has been as an expert witness in court, sometimes for the defence, sometimes for the prosecution. One of the more interesting ones was a chap who was who strangled, he was a musician, lived in Brighton, and strangled a young woman in his own home who had come round to visit his girlfriend. And he claimed in his defence that it was an accidental strangling in the course of consensual breath play. So my job was to look at the details of all of that, and he'd done things like deposited the corpse in the big yellow storage down the road and went back to visit it intermittently, as though he was taking necrophiliac pleasure in studying the decay of the body. His defence was not well received by the jury, as you can imagine. There was evidence that he had been consulting hardcore pornography relating to that kind of scenario before the event, and that he had confessed to medical experts that he was afraid that he might kill a woman, that he had this sort of urge that was pointing him that way. So there was quite a lot of circumstantial evidence that that it was not an accident. And I think he was rightfully convicted.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Moving on to the Yorkshire Ripper, obviously a notorious serial killer. Tell me where he comes into, in terms of traits and description of a serial killer.
Well, he's an almost perfect, typical serial killer, in the sense that he's motivated primarily by sexual excitement, despite the fact that he picked up on the police theory that he hated prostitutes specifically, and was hearing voices of God, that he was on a mission to rid the world of these evil women. I think that's just a rationalization. I think that he was turned on by the act of killing these women. And the mistake the police made in this instance, of course, was to presume that it was only prostitutes that he was targeting. The women, a number of the women that he had attacked, including some who survived, to give a very good description of Peter Sutcliffe, were not sex workers. They were just women who happened to come within his ambit at the time, and he followed them into remote places. But he had this MO of hitting them on the back of the head with a hammer and then gouging them in the stomach with a screwdriver. So obviously he's a man who carries a toolkit around with him, and was quite widely travelled around the Yorkshire region, so you presume that he would be driving a vehicle of some sort. His brother apparently reported that he got turned on by a waxwork exhibition in Blackpool, which showed some medical education torsos of women in various stages of pregnancy, with a sort of a window in the belly that you could peer through and look at the developing embryo. And according to Sutcliffe's brother, he would loiter around this exhibit as though he found it rather intriguing.
I'd forgotten about that, but it's a very interesting point, actually. I'm sure he never went to Madame Tussauds. Moving on to Stuart Kind, while writing my book, I found that he took quite a unique approach in solving the Yorkshire Ripper case. Take a listen.
The psychiatric side of forensic science is shrouded in mystery. But every now and again, its experts astound the world of law enforcement with their abilities in the face of the most appalling crimes. Many forensic scientists, especially those who study psychological behavior, prefer to remain in the shadows. As a result, relatively little is known about one such forensic expert who played a significant role in helping to bring one of Britain's most notorious serial killers, the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, to justice. Professor Stuart Kind helped police crack the long unsolved case by literally plotting the murderous path of violence. It was an unusual approach back in the early 1980s and sparked a lot of criticism at the time. It was only some years later that Professor Kind got the credit he fully deserved. The Yorkshire Ripper police investigation itself was dogged with problematical leads, including detectives being diverted for several months by a taped message purporting to be from the murderer, in which he taunted them. Officers were convinced the voice was the actual killer, but in fact it was all a hoax and resulted in a lot of public criticism of Yorkshire Police's Ripper Squad and its investigative skills. Professor Kind originally came onto the investigation in late 1980 as a member of an advisory team which included four senior police officers. In many ways, it was a last throw of the dice by police. He was immediately treated like an eccentric, detached boffin when it came to his plans to forensically examine the case. Kind ignored all the skeptics and eventually applied his own unique navigational ideas in regard to the multiple murders. He reworked all the data known up to that time about the Yorkshire Ripper, who'd killed prostitutes in and around the Yorkshire city of Bradford. In the late autumn of 1980, Kind spent 17 days re-examining in minute detail the progress of the inquiry from every angle. He produced his own hypotheses of the suspect by combining a number of individual findings into a general statement, which he believed could be interpreted into being actual facts about the suspect. Kind later explained that the mental procedure of producing such a hypothesis was extremely complex. The scientist carefully made his deductions based on the logical consequences of the information he'd been provided with. It eventually emerged that much of Professor Kind's knowledge about the Yorkshire Ripper was based around just one meeting with detectives leading the hunt. All his other information about the case came from newspaper reports. This strategy continued to be treated with great caution by the police and the general public. It also provoked a lot of suspicion and criticism inside the forensic science community. Some accused Professor Kind of promoting the use of outrageous guesswork, which wasn't backed up by any scientific data.
I wonder what your feelings were about Professor Stuart Kind, whose big claim to fame was his work on the Yorkshire Ripper. Even though he entered into a very large grey area, he relied on scientific hypothesis. What are your feelings about that?
I know that the police were rather badly misled by a bogus recording sent by a bloke with a Geordie accent, and as a result, they interviewed Sutcliffe about 9 times and put him aside because he had the wrong accent, despite the fact that he looked exactly like the photo fits that had been provided by victims who had survived an attack from Sutcliffe, and that the police were not linking because they were not sex workers. So that was the big mistake that the police made there. But in retrospect, when we look back on this whole thing, of course, because Sutcliffe was a long-distance lorry driver operating between, Wick and Southampton, we might not have been linking up a whole lot of killings that were he was responsible for that were not in the Yorkshire region.
Well, that's a very interesting point. And also getting back to Stuart Kind, who, when I was a reporter all those years ago during that period, he became a sort of celeb of the psychiatric world, even though what he was doing really didn't bear that much resemblance to the world of psychology. However, he worked out a lot of things about Sutcliffe by using the geographical positions of each killing, and that in a way segued into what you were saying earlier.
Yes, that's right. It'd be a kind of triangulation. I think the killings were occurring in 2 particular parts of Yorkshire and moving the other side of the Pennines, and you could slot Sutcliffe's home was actually right in the middle of that triangle. But in fact, they picked him up in the red light district of Leeds, and just by accident, he was sitting in his car, and they discovered that the car was of interest. I think people had been noting the car in relation to some of these crimes. And Sutcliffe said, do you mind if I go and have a pee in the shrubberies? And he unloaded his toolkit, apparently. And they afterwards thought, well, that's a bit funny. I wonder what he was doing in there. And they went back and found the tools. And that was what really nailed Sutcliffe, I think, that he'd been disposing of the weapons.
What about during the process of your research into cases? I know that you primarily, as you've already said, appear as a witness, but you've obviously met some serial killers, I presume, as part of your research. What sort of impression have they given you?
No, I can't say I have met any of the famous serial killers, even Rose West, that I was working on her defence, but unsuccessfully, that is, because my brief was to write a report on her personality based on all of the witness reports about her behaviour to see whether they could support the case that she was a dupe of Fred and that if she hadn't met him, that she would have been on the straight and narrow. The report that I wrote, they did not find very helpful because I found to the effect that she was exactly the sort of woman who, within a folie à deux with Fred, would have contributed to these, based mainly on witness reports victims that had survived and said that Rose was just as brutal as Fred was. But on the question of what are they like, one thing that comes through quite often is a total lack of a sense of humour. They're very much on guard whenever you're talking to them, and as though whatever they say is going to give them away, and they're inclined not to be flippant about anything. Back in the days when the Yorkshire Ripper was operating, I was asked by a tabloid newspaper to say what sort of person should the police be looking for. And I didn't have a clue, as a matter of fact, but I just thought off the top of my head, I would look for a man who would be wearing a suit at the beach and has no sense of humour. And so that got written up in the tabloids. And one of the policemen who had visited Sutcliffe before he was arrested said, the thing that made me most suspicious about him was that neither he nor his wife had any sense of humour whatsoever. He must have tried a joke on the doorstep or something which fell rather badly flat. If they do have a sense of humour at all, I think that it's entirely malicious and at the expense of their victim. It's not a sense of humour that you would recognise a normal, healthy, functioning person to have.
Does that mean that when they try to play a police investigator or anyone, a journalist, whoever, that they don't have any charm, so they're not going to do a very good job of it? And therefore, everything you're dealing with, from what you're saying, sounds a bit bland, in a sense.
Well, interestingly, a few of them do have charm. It's not charm in the sense of a sense of humour, but charm in the sense of being very good-looking and smooth-talking. Like Ted Bundy would chat up the women to help him into the car with his supermarket shopping, and they would go in after the shopping. So some of them do have charm, but I think we overestimate that because it applies mostly to the successful ones who have got away with it for a long period of time and who give a very good press interview if Piers Corbyn or somebody comes round. Hence, they are better known than the ones who get caught maybe on their first outing. They're the ones that don't have the charm or the IQ.
Have you always been able to keep a distance emotionally? What serial killing cases have actually moved you?
I can't say that I've liked any of them that I've read about. And I think that they are manipulative, psychopathic people. Seldom mad in the psychiatric or legal sense of the term of being out of contact with reality. They do have severe personality disorders that make them totally narcissistic and manipulative. Psychopathic is the simplest description of it. And this is why they will go about doing it. If they can't become president of the United States, they become serial killers.
Going back to something maybe which relates to profiling, but something I find quite disturbing in a sense, the McDonald triad, the fact that animal cruelty, fire setting, bedroom. What are your feelings about this? I think it goes back to a certain degree of what we were talking about in terms of profiling.
Right. When you see those traits in the one person, as you say, animal cruelty, fire setting for purposes of excitement, and bedwetting into late teens, when you see all three of those, it certainly implies a dysfunctional background, which is characteristic of a lot of serial killers, but you can't argue it the other way. The majority of serial killers do not exhibit those traits. So it's not a good indicator from that point of view. Things like early childhood trauma, brain injury, severe child abuse, can even things like infantile meningitis and so on, can impair the restraint processes in the frontal cortex of the brain that prevent an individual from acting out deviant sexual fantasies. So those are better indicators. Animal cruelty is not a good sign because that is, of the three, that's the better indicator of psychopathy.
Yes, I was going to say the other two, fire setting and bedwetting. I've got four kids. I think applies to most of them when they were children. And there's a lot of kids who are mini pyromaniacs.
Yeah, to sort of strike matches and so on in the garden. But I suppose the sort of fire setting that is indicative of serial killing is the kind where you light the fire in a suburb and enjoy watching the fire brigade rushing around trying to put it out. And it gives a sense of potency. I think that's where the connection with psychopathy comes.
Now, the next question is really a shot in the dark. It may sound ludicrous, but I'm going to say it anyway. If you had some CCTV footage of a suspect, we know most CCTV footage is pretty grainy and you can't make out much. But if you just had a suspect walking along the road for 2 or 3 minutes on this footage, could you work out any characterization about that person from the way they're walking? If you could see what they were wearing or any other aspect of it?
Yes, obviously if they're wearing clothes that are going to make the CCTV less useful, that's a bad sign, particularly when you're wandering around with gloves on a hot night. the other thing about, there is something about a loiterer in which he doesn't seem to be specifically going from A to B, but wandering around sort of looking for trouble, or else looking for people who might be observing him. Or in pursuit in some way. So it's the direction of gaze, I think, might tell you something about the way that the person is behaving in public.
And you must feel, after all the years you've been involved in this, there's a frustrating aspect to being a forensic psychologist, because surely so many killers might have been prevented from murdering people if they'd been treated earlier, given therapy, or when obvious warning signs came up. And maybe the system is better now. Do you feel that's the situation?
I'm not sure, really, whether there is anything that can be done to prevent these exceptional people in acting out their fantasies. In the case of somebody like Dennis Nielsen, of course, he was not easily caught because he was carefully choosing victims who would not be missed. And we wouldn't have known that he was moving in a necrophile direction on the basis of observing his reaction to seeing his grandfather in the open coffin. It would be so internal. It would be, and it would be something that would be incubated in fantasy, probably in connection with masturbation, as he grew up, and so that it would become more and more compelling when he gets into his early adult years. In the case of some serial killers, of course, as testosterone declines, the urge for any sort of sexual activity, deviant or otherwise, does tend to diminish. And that's probably why serial killers tend to begin while young and may even possibly retire in the Middle Ages.
I mean, we've heard of serial killers, particularly the one in California, the interstate killer. He was brought to justice after a huge gap. Now, I can't believe he wasn't killing during that gap.
I think that's possible. He might have just exhausted it, and as his testosterone declined into his 70s, he sort of lost the urge or was better able to contain it. But the interesting thing about him, of course, is that he began in East Sacramento. He was a policeman, a working policeman, and as things got hotter, he went to West Sacramento, and then he started moving down to San Francisco in the Bay Area, and ultimately down to Southern California. So I suppose what you're wondering, and he might have gone off to the East Coast or something as another happy hunting ground, but there was no evidence that he ever really left his home in East Sacramento, because that's where they found him. And I don't think he had any record of living in any state other than California.
I see cases in the papers sometimes or on TV of murders where one murder is alleged to have been committed. And it's like the police have somehow managed to bring this person to justice, but they never get done for other murders. And yet you feel certain their MO means that they're blatantly similar to a serial killer and that there must be other victims in the past. Do you ever come across cases where you look at that and wonder?
Yeah, I wonder that about the guy in Brighton that strangled his partner's friend, whether if they hadn't got him on that, he might have carried on somewhere else.
And what age was he?
He was a young man, I think in his early to mid-20s.
Right, so if he'd been in his mid-30s, it would be more likely he'd killed before.
Yes, that's right. The Ipswich killer, Steve Wright, yes, that's right. He killed a number of sex workers in the Ipswich area, for which they ultimately got him. But he was in his mid-40s, I think, by the time that end game occurred. And looking back, he had worked as a barman in Norwich, I believe, and there had been a number of unsolved cases of women being found dumped in watery ditches and woodland just outside of Norwich, which would have been the MO of Steve Wright. So it's highly likely that he had a background as a serial killer before he turned up in Ipswich.
Now, we've been sitting here for an hour having a fascinating discussion about serial killing. serial killers, rather. And do you think there's a danger that as a society we've accepted that they exist, and the combination of true crime, including books that I write and maybe books that you've written and everything we've both probably said on TV, plus Hollywood dramas, have deadened most people's responses to serial killings?
Boy, even more chilling is the possibility that people actually get excited by the concept of serial killers. Some of the more famous ones have fan groups. Ted Bundy in particular, and there are still people wearing Ted Bundy T-shirts and hats, and one woman even had his bite marks tattooed. But I think what we're actually observing is a preparation for coping with an actual horrific event, which is why we watch disaster movies, horror films, and so on. It helps prepare us for the eventuality should it occur to us in real life. It's a rehearsal of the coping mechanism.
It's an interesting thing to think about. Completely last question now, very basic, but something one I feel obliged to ask. Do you think there are a lot of serial killers still out there? Or do you think, as some people do, that because of CCTV, hate to be simplistic about it, therapy, the social services system, all these things which are presumably being operated rather more efficiently than they were maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago. Do you think that that's cut down the number of serial killers, or do you just think they're getting cleverer at getting away with it?
Yeah, I think there are a few serial killers out there, not so many as there might have been back in the 1970s, for example, when people could move around a bit and out of the ambit of a particular police jurisdiction so that they were not good at putting their records together. I think modern techniques of crime scene linkage, as you say, CCTV, DNA is a big one, enable us to catch people more quickly, and most of them before they get to qualify as a serial killer by killing three people. Most of them are probably caught first time out.
But one last point, which is very important in relation to DNA. Do you really believe that a serial killer, fevered up, wanting to find a victim, is going to care about the fact that DNA might bring him to justice more quickly?
If they don't, they are likely to get caught. And as I say, I think that's probably why there are a few serial killers operating at the moment. I think we are better at detecting them. And I don't think psychologists can take the credit, certainly not therapists. but police detection methods generally have improved.
That's absolutely true, Glenn. Thank you very, very much. I'm so glad that we were able to, at least in an hour, look a little bit beneath the skin of this subject.
Yeah, thank you, Wensley. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to The Real Silent Witnesses, The Serial Killers. In the last hour, we've chatted with Professor Glenn Wilson about the typical traits of serial killers and how to spot them. Personally, I was surprised to know that police techniques and geographical profiling may well be more useful than actual psychology when it comes to catching serial killers. Obviously, the views and thoughts I've expressed in this podcast are entirely my own. Remember, it's a free world and you can think whatever you want. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're at it, if you like the show, we'd appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend about what you've heard. For a more in-depth analysis into forensics, check out my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses, which is available at all good stores, including Audible and Apple Books, and published by W.F. Howes. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And remember, the dead tell us everything.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.